Yes, okay. Thank you very much, Pierre, and thank you all to the other organizers. I mean, it's an absolutely wonderful workshop. So what I want to do is I want to explain you a little bit about this KPC. So KPC, well, I guess, well, a few people here are still there anyway. So the KPC is, of course, not the one from the sort of quantum gravity, but that's Kata, Parisi, and Tsang. And I mean, just sort of for those people who have never seen the equation, let me just write it down. Actually, it's not very important because I'm will be going to look at very concrete models. But let me sort of put the equation anyhow. And so you have an height function h, which depends on x and t, and so you have a substrate x, which is an rd, and you have a time t larger than zero, and then you write down a stochastic evolution equation for this height function. Let me just write down the equation without actually entering into the physics. I mean, you will see in a second what kind of physics this is going to describe. So you write ddt of h, then there is the nonlinearity, which is the gradient squared. Okay, then there's the diffusive term plus the eta, and the eta of x and t is roughly white noise. And the nu is the diffusion coefficient, which should be strictly positive. And we are going to look at this equation in one dimension. Okay. Now, I'm not going to go into all of the history. I mean, this sort of would be a rather boring lecture. Rather, what I would like to concentrate on is this paper here by Bjornsson, which sort of started, in some sense, somewhat. I mean, they actually studied a purely combinatorial problem, which is called the Ulam's problem. But for the expert, it was clear that, you know, this could be translated into analyzing a gross model, which falls into the class of Kata, Parisi, and Tsang. And this paper was sort of surprising in two respects. I mean, the first one is that they were able to compute quantities exactly, which so far, despite the fact that, you know, many people have been looking at this equation, they're not able to do. And the second thing which was surprising is the technique in using this kind of in obtaining these exact solutions, they're actually related to random matrices, which sort of looks a rather sort of, you know, wild guess from the beginning. So, I mean, my very modest task for these 2 hours will be just to explain you a little bit of how this one-dimensional prose is related to random matrices and how one can obtain some exact answers for this kind of models. Now, if you want to look a little bit on the literature, I mean, I've lectured in Leuven, that's sort of the summer school on fundamental problems in statistical mechanics, and for this purpose, I wrote up sort of a review article. So presumably, this is a place where you can sort of get all the material. During the talk, I will mention essentially no names because I just want to tell you the story, and so. I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, I mean, I don't want to give proper credit. It just means that it would be not so interesting. So if you want to look up, I mean, it's in this place where you can get all the information. So the way how I want to construct the talk is that I first want to talk about the corner prose model. Okay, then the second thing would be, I will talk about matrix value diffusion. And, there will be the break, and then there comes sort of the central thing, which is this RSK construction, which relates the gross models to random matrices. And then the first thing will be the edge scaling, which is the method to actually obtain objects of physical interest. Edge scaling.
What does RSK stand for?
This is Robinson, Schenstedt, and Knut. I'll come to this. Okay. All right. Now, another thing which I would like to do is, I mean, since we had a lot of talks here sort of on two-dimensional field theories, I would like to explain to you how these kind of models actually fit into sort of two-dimensional field theories. I mean, you know, it fits sort of not as properly as you would hope, but there are surprisingly many connections, and not all of them have been yet sort of completely elucidated. So this is sort of one other goal which I have with these lectures. Okay, so let me start with this Kornock-Gross model, and let me first sort of do this on the blackboard and then switch to the transparency. So the Kornock-Gross models, you should think that you have sort of like a cone. And just like what Carter Parisi-Sung had in mind, I mean, you want to look at a deposition type model, so you have material which is sort of dropping onto a surface and then sticking. And in this Kornock-Gross model, you do the following sort of simple construction. Imagine that you have tilted the square lattice at 45 degrees. And then you drop material, but this takes a little time. So the idea is that this is sort of the substrate which is prescribed, and then you have a random time which in our case will have an exponential distribution which fills up local minima. So at that stage I have just only this one local minimum, so I have to wait an exponential distributed time, and then I'm filling up this local minimum. And as I filled it up, I mean, there will be two local minima which I have created. I mean, the surface is now looking like this. Okay, I have two local minima which are created. And to each one of them, I have an independent exponentially distributed waiting time. So they are just running. So let's say, you know, it's running, and maybe this one is sort of somewhat shorter. So here I have another one which is filled. Okay. Now this, of course, keeps going, but at this very moment I have created a new local minimum. So I'm going to fill this up. I mean, I will assign to this another independent exponentially distributed waiting time. And then, you know, the system runs, and then after a while, I will sort of maybe fill up this one. Okay, then I have new two minima which are created. Now I have sort of three possible growth sites, each of one sort of waiting to be filled, etc., etc. So this is the Kornock-Gross model. And I've put this again here on the transparency, so you can see more clearly what's actually going on. So these are just... Excuse me. All this growth times are independent, and for my purpose, I want to even fix exactly the distribution. Namely, they just have an exponential identical. I mean, let's say mean one exponential distribution. Okay. Okay. So here is again. I mean, this picture. I have here in this case. I have sort of two possible growth sites, and of course, as I keep going, there will be more and more, and each one of them will be filled after this random time. It's useful to introduce sort of a coordinate system. There will be the J coordinate, which is sort of the spatial coordinate. There's the height, which gives you the current surface profile. And therefore, you know, it's sort of at time t, I will have a certain height profile, which is h sub j at time t. I mean, the height, of course, takes here discrete values. Time is continuous, and space is also discrete. And if you wait sufficiently long, then of course eventually you will see sort of a macroscopic shape, which in our particular case can be computed. It's actually sort of a half circle, which is tangent to the cone. And so roughly what you will see after a long time is a well-defined surface, which has sort of a little fluctuations. And the whole object of the talk is sort of to study these fluctuations. So you see that, I mean, you know, we had a lot of SLEs here. I mean, the object is geometrically, of course, much less exciting than what you see in SLE, but still I hope to convince you that that these statistical properties are quite intriguing. Okay, so what is the quantity which one would sort of, you know, imagine to study first? Well, I mean, one of the simplest quantity is you sort of sit at the origin, so I sit exactly here at the tip of the cone, and I'm recording the height above the origin. So I'm recording this distance here. And so that's the height at location zero at time t. And you see there will be lots of other times occurring during this talk. And so therefore, I mean, I carefully distinguish that at the moment, I mean, t denotes the growth time. So that's the physical time, you know, under which this sort of surface is actually growing. Okay? All right, anyway, so here you have this is a sort of to leading order, you know, if sort of if I develop a macroscopic profile, it just means that this distance should be proportional to t. And so to leading order, I will get a deterministic value which is c time t, and of course this c is depends on this particular model, and depends also, you know, at the location which I'm looking. I mean, if I would be called the c as a function of the macroscopic location, then this would be this macroscopic profile. Okay, so this is sort of the leading term, and then there will be a fluctuating convection, which is of the whole interest. I mean, first of all, it has a size which goes like t to the alpha. Then there is some number which sort of determines sort of well, okay. So then there's a random amplitude, which sort of is the whole. I mean, that's the quantity which we really want to study. And then of course there's another number. I mean, somehow one wants to make this this random amplitude. This random amplitude will turn out to be sort of the same in a large variety of models. Therefore, the way we want to put these numbers is that we sort of put all non-universal quantities into these coefficients. I mean, so this is this growth speed. I mean, this will be something which depends very much on the model. If I take instead of an exponential distribution, I take some other distribution, this I will change this coefficient. Of course, it will change also this coefficient, but the claim is that it will not change the exponent, and it will not change the random amplitude. And therefore, I mean, what I sort of underlined here is sort of simply a dividing between non-universals and universal quantities. And in the following, you will see that I'm going to drop all these non-universal quantities and just put them equal to 1. I mean, just make sort of the presentation more transparent.
I have a question. So is this what the solution of that equation?
No, forget about this equation. I mean, I'm going to study this model, okay?
No, and then,
yeah. Well, okay, this is exactly what I want to drop. I mean, you know, this of course has been elucidated, and there are many papers, but I just sort of would sort of defocus what I want to say. I mean, so I just wanted to write down this equation for those people who sort of have seen it, and I will not say a single word about how this very little about how this equation is really related to the model, okay? Maybe we can do this sort of afterwards, so to speak, and once we understand the properties of the model, we could go back to this equation and see, you know, what I mean, how is it actually connected, okay? But this will not be the main focus.
So now, the profile in space, on average, is not flat, I guess.
No, it's not flat. I mean, in this particular case, so it depends on how I put it. But in this very particular case, it's actually a circle which is tangent to the cone. I mean, in this case, you can compute it. In other cases, you know, if the model is more complicated, you will not be able to compute it. But you know sort of abstractly that there will be a macroscopic profile. And it can be flat in particular cases, but not necessarily. Yeah. It just means that you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, there's sort of little mass sort of, you know, sitting at the side of the cone. I mean, it would be actually surprising if you think, you know, physically, if you think about this deposition process, it would be surprising if it's completely flat. I mean. Yeah, you can do that also. I mean, you can sort of peel off mass. Yeah, if you prefer. I mean, that's it's sort of a question what kind of physical imagination you want to have behind. But if you think in terms of KPC, sort of the original motivation was to describe ballistic deposition, and therefore I'm using this kind of time axis.
So the model built by prescribing the law of Poisson.
No, the model in this my particular case, the model is defined by describing this random waiting time, which in our case is fixed and which is exponential. And what I want to get, what I want to find out is what is the statistical law of this random amplitude. Okay? And of course, in the back of my mind is that this is something which will be universal and will not depend so much on the specific model I'm studying, but it's sort of like investigating critical points at the Ising model. Now, I would like to prefer to study one very specific model and then later on worry about, you know, issues of universality.
Question. Is there any kind of conformal invariance in this quantum space, and if maybe not a H, but some other profile, initial profile?
Yes.
And then, of course, the classical distribution.
Yes.
But it can be recomputed, of course.
Yes. Not at that stage. I think if you make you know, sort of a cone which is sort of somewhat differently shaped. I mean, this will change all the non-universal quantities. I mean, you know, will change the C and the C1. But this thing will actually remain the same. Well, we will come to it. I mean, so let's see.
Because convex and the concave, the concave the problem is meaningless. You can have definitely not the problem of variety in general.
It is
love that as negative.
That's correct. Yes, very good. No, I mean, so this is one of the predictions of the KPC equation, that the sign of the nonlinearity. I mean, this is what is he referred to. I mean, that's the lambda here. Doesn't make any difference. Could be either positive or negative. You will see the same universal behavior. In some models, I mean, I will show you other models where it's sort of where the lambda has a different sign. I mean, yes.
There is also connection to representation theory.
Yeah, coming. Yeah, I will come to that. Okay. So let's first...
Before we go, can I just ask, I think I missed that. What determines alpha?
Not yet. I'm just saying. No. I mean, this. I'm coming to it. What I'm saying is that you know, the most naive sort of ansatz which you would make for this height as a function of time at the origin is that you have the linear piece. I mean, that's sort of obvious. And then there will be a fluctuating convection. And what I have to determine is the scaling exponent alpha and the universal random amplitude psi. It's an ansatz. I'm not saying that, you know, I still have to figure out what these objects are.
Okay, but there's three options apparently for alpha.
Okay, no, I didn't tell you yet. I mean, so okay. All right. So the next thing is what is alpha? So this was the question of, you know, what do we expect? What do we expect for this random amplitude? Well, there are sort of two naive things which you might think. I mean, first thing is you say, well, you know, I'm sort of dropping things more or less independently, and therefore, what you would think is that it sort of corresponds to like you know, essentially sort of random nucleation events. I mean, sort of random increases of this height. And on this basis, you would think that the alpha should be 1/2. It's just sort of ordinary central limit theorem, and the distribution of psi should be Gauss. Okay, so that's option number one. Option number two is that you say, well, look, I mean, this is not so rather silly. I mean, you know, it's really what you do in this statistical process, you effectively create something like a surface tension. That's something which we know very well from thermal equilibrium. And the thermal equilibrium case would correspond to half of your proposal. I mean, you know, you here I sort of randomly deposit, but you could also sort of take away randomly things. And if I do this in equal proportion, then this is sort of the thermal equilibrium situation. In this case, it's sort of clear that you create a surface tension. So this sort of suppresses surface fluctuations. And if you do the same, and then you say, okay, you know, it's more or less like equilibrium, but then there will be sort of simply a net drift and everything is moving upwards, right? And so if this is your picture, then what you will find is that the alpha should be 1/4, but the distribution is still Gauss. Okay? And the prediction of KPC is that the alpha will be 1/3, and in fact that this object can be computed on the basis of random The prediction of KPC is that the exponent is 1/3, and the new development of Beigleift and Johansson is that this distribution can be computed on the basis of random matrix theory. Okay? So now the very first thing which I would like to convince you is, you know, despite the fact that you know, maybe it sort of takes time away from other things, but the very first thing is, I mean, if you have not really thought about such kind of questions, I would like to convince you why there must be some sort of critical behavior going on in this model. Okay? I mean, I want to convince you that you know, these two options are extremely unlikely, and then in fact it must be sort of like 1/3 without actually going to you know, the Carter-Parisi-San theory, just doing some simple probabilistic type of consideration. So this is what I want to do next. So first I want to explain you why it must be, I mean, why it's expected to be non-Gaussian, and then I want to sort of tell you two other things. I mean, first of all, this is something which Carter-Parisi-Sang observed already. All these models are related to directed polymer models and sort of in a disordered medium. I mean, so it's sort of more like you know, sort of a disordered equilibrium problem from statistical mechanics. You might wonder how this appears in this model. And then the next thing which I want to address before sort of getting into more details, I sort of want to give you a feeling of how difficult this problem is. I mean, I'm just writing down, you know, this model, but it's sort of standing at the moment rather isolated. And so I would like to connect it to models which at least I sort of assume that this audience sort of is familiar with, and so you have some feeling of, you know, whether the problem is very simple or whether very difficult. Okay. Yes. Yes.
this H is KPZ.
No, this H is the H as defined by my model, okay? Yeah, sure. I mean, eventually in some sort of continuum limit, you know, it's sort of like asking... In some sort of continuum limit, it will be described by this equation, yes? But that's exactly an issue which I don't want to discuss. It's sort of like, you know, you explain to somebody the easing model, and then somebody says, look, but there's also the phi to the fourth field theory. I mean, how is it connected? Fine, you know, that's an issue which is important, but I just don't want to discuss it here.
But for KPZ, I mean, since you mentioned this KPZ growth,
I'm saying that the KPC prediction on this model is very definite. I mean, you know, there's simply no doubt that once you have seen the model and anybody who ever studied this theory, that he will really make the prediction that this exponent alpha must be 1/3. I mean, that's all what I'm saying. Which is the prediction of KPC, yes. I'm just saying that, if I know a little bit about their theory, I immediately will come to the conclusion that it must be 1/3.
Okay, now my question is, yes. If this was KPZH, and with this new development by RMT, can you calculate all this prefecture?
Like
H square average.
Oh yeah, sure. Yeah. All these things. Yes, all these things are confirmed. All are contained in this random amplitude. If I tell you what is the distribution of the random amplitude, I can compute all the moments of H. Okay? Yes. No, definitely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now let me first sort of back up again. Aha. So I see I have sort of experts here. So anyway, so let me sort of just do as I planned originally. So the first question I want to address is, you know, why do you expect it to be non-Gaussian and sort of more critical like? Okay. So the idea is very simple. Well, let's just compute the generating function. If I would know what the generating function is, I mean, then of course it must contain all the information which I've displayed on the board, right? I mean, if you're able to compute this quantity, and then, of course, you know all the statistical properties. Okay? Of course, that's not so easy, so this doesn't work so well. And so let's do a little bit more modestly. Let's try to compute this generating function on the coarsest possible scale. And you see, it's sort of like a partition function. This H is proportional to time, and therefore the coarsest scale would be is just to compute the logarithm of the partition function, divide by t, and then take the limit as c going to infinity. Of course, then I'm losing a lot of statistical information, right? It's much less than what I really wanted to know, which is sort of a precise fluctuation behavior. But usually we know that sort of non-smoothness of the free energy is related to sort of critical type of behavior. So I'm just trying to use this idea, okay? Well, so what is this sort of free energy type function f of lambda? Well, I still don't know how to compute it. I mean, you know, it's sort of, I don't know how to compute this. I have no idea how to compute this either, right? I mean, that's already a little bit simpler, but nevertheless, I mean, it's sort of not so easily accessible. So now let me do a trick which is sort of very common in probability theory. Namely, rather than trying to look at this object, you know, which of course well-defined, but on which you might have very little intuition, let's look at sort of the corresponding Lechendre transform. This corresponds to going from the canonical to the microcanonical ensemble, right? So rather trying to compute the generating function, let's compute the probability that this height function is deviating from its typical value, which is c times t, by an amount which is proportional to t. So it's a huge amount. So this is something which is usually called a large deviation. And it's clear that this probability will be extremely small, but that's exactly what we want to compute. Okay? Now, let's see whether we can sort of make some guesses. Well, let's first assume that we want to look, I want to make the delta first negative, I guess. Let's see, what did I put here? Yeah, okay, so let's first make the delta negative. Okay, so here's my cone. Okay, so this is the typical profile which I expect after a long time. And now I want to ask myself, so this thing is here proportional to t, right? I mean, this is a large object. Now I want to ask, what is the probability of finding in my realization a height which is delta t below the typical value? I mean, how would I manage? Well, you see, it's not so difficult, because the way how I could manage is, for instance, you see, I'm willing to, it's a small probability, so I'm willing to look at events of very small probability. Well, one thing how I could
do this, I simply say, well,
I simply never start the growing process. I just sort of, the square down here, I just leave it empty. I mean, that's of course a small probability, but since I'm looking at small probabilities, I can do it, right? Now this of course will be not a very good idea because then I never reach this. So in fact, what I will do is, in order to get this probability, all what I have to do is I make the squares which are right below the origin, right above the origin, I just let them sort of grow a little bit slower than the rest. Okay? And then at this stage, I mean, you know, the height profile will be indeed a distance delta t below the typical value. And therefore what I conclude is now, you know, the number of squares for which I have to make this slower is proportional to t, and therefore what I conclude is that this sort of microcanonical type of partition function will go like e to the minus c with some prefactor which I work a little bit harder can be actually figured out also. Okay? Now let's look at, this is sort of the lower tail, now let's look at the upper tail. So now I want to ask how would I manage in order to sort of see my height profile not below the typical value but above the typical value. So I want to have it somewhere up here. Okay? Now you say, well, okay, that's easy. You see, all what I have to do is maybe I have to sort of speed up this, you know, these things a little bit. Okay? But this doesn't work, you see, because in order for this to have been growing, I also must grow the sideward columns. And to grow the sideward column, I have to grow its sideward column, etc. And so what you will see is that eventually, in order to reach this one, I have to displace the whole profile. So all of these things have to sort of move a little bit faster than what I expected them to do. Therefore, what I have to do, I have sort of t squared exponential distribution, which have to go a little bit faster. And therefore, this probability will be also very small, but it will be proportional to t squared.
Why, for a minute, if anything, you didn't care about side columns?
Because I don't have to, because you see, the side columns are sort of automatically blocked. I mean, this is what my beginning example was. You see, if I block the lowest side here, everything else is blocked. I will never start growing. If I don't fill this one, nothing is going to grow. So you see, the blocking is very effective if I want to be below the typical profile. If I want to be above, I mean, it's very highly ineffective. And therefore, what I conclude is that if I look at this microcanonical description, you see that the corresponding thermodynamic potential, if you allow this word, sort of will have two different scalings in terms of the volume. One is proportional to 2, the other one is proportional to t squared. Therefore, it can never be a smooth function. Okay, it's not a theorem, but it's, I think, a very convincing argument, and I think that's really what is behind this whole thing.
Okay? It's in the sense argument for like t, but then you want to go to
the... That's right. Okay, so now you can work out this thing much more precisely, and what you find, I mean, you know, this is something I don't want to explain here, but what you find is that on this basis, if you compute these functions with greater care and then you make a fit of the upper and the lower tail, then you find that indeed you get the alpha equal to 1/3. In fact, you can even get the tails of this distribution here. If you look at this random amplitude, that's the random amplitude here. If you look at the tails of the distribution, you can get even these out of this large deviation kind of. Okay, so this was number one. Now number two was, I have to watch out, but anyway. So let's just do this. Okay, so next thing is I wanted to explain you how the directed polymer appears in this problem and why this is related to disordered systems. I mean, that's sort of a completely generic thing, and I just want to tell you how this appears in this very particular model, okay? So now, again, I'm looking here at my tilted square lattice. I mean, I have the coordinates which are n and m. And now I want to look at the time when the square mn is first filled. Okay? So let's look at a simple example. I mean, suppose this is the square 1, 1. I want to look at the time where this one is first filled. And you see that what I have to do is I have to fill this one and I have to fill this one. So this time will be the maximum of this path and of this path. Okay? And this is completely generic, and so let me just, you know, this is just a local rule, since but it's everywhere, you know, I have to take the maximum of the various possibilities, and if I sort of do this for sites which are further away, then you get to the following construction. So let me just sort of put this down here. So now I sort of tilt it because it's easier to plot. I mean, so this is NMN here, sort of my square lattice. And to each one of these squares, I assigned my waiting time, which I call WMN. and which in our case are independent exponentially distributed random variables. So they are sitting here on these squares, okay? And then following this idea, I take a path, which you see in this case it can go either this way or this way. So it's sort of like a random walk. If I tilt it by 45 degrees, then I take paths omegas, which start, well, just a path omega, which walks on this lattice, and the only moves it's allowed to do, it's either allowed to go to the right or it's allowed to move up. So I have an upright path, and to conform with the physical sign conventions, I sort of smuggled in a minus sign. So if I want to look at the energy of such a walk, I simply collect the energies along the walk, the waiting times along the walk. So I take, I sum over all squares along the walk, and I simply see what kind of potential I have at this walk. And then I put the minus sign so that I actually have to minimize the energy, okay? And then the assertion, but here I take the maximum. Because of this minus sign, I take the minimum. And therefore, the minus this time at lattice side mn is the minimum, and I have to minimize over all walks which start at 1, 1. They must be upright, and they end up at this endpoint, which is mn. And of course, I have to minimize the energy. Okay? And if I, what is of course usually done, if I take out these two minus signs here, then the energy in quotes would be again the sum along the walk. But here I would have to maximize rather than minimize. So it's really, in the usual language, it's the last passage percolation problem. But it's fine. I mean, you know, it's sort of just a question of science. I mean, okay. So conclusion of this transparency is that, you know, as in all of these models, there's an associated sort of optimization problem, which in the physical literature is exactly what is called the directed polymer in a random medium. And it's a very specific directed polymer, and it's a very specific van der medium. Okay, the next issue I want to sort of try to sort of convince you how difficult is the problem. Okay, sort of see how this actually. Okay, in order to understand this, what you want to do is it's convenient to look at slopes. So here I take the height differences at two neighboring points, and this is of the slope by these variables. I think of occupation variables, so I take 0, 1. So the slopes are either plus 1 or minus 1. Okay, and then you can ask yourself, if I know what is the evolution of the height, what is the evolution of the slopes? And of course, the evolution of the slopes is extremely simple. You see, what's happening here is that I have, in this picture, okay, so here is my cone. Okay, in this picture, you know, according to these definitions, the occupation variables are all 1 over here, and they're all 0 down here. And as I fill this one, it just means that, I have to draw this off lattice, so to speak. Okay. Anyway. So if I fill this one, then what this means is that this particle is jumping to the right, and it leaves behind a hole, and this side is now occupied, and then it continues like this. Okay. So it's extremely simple sort of evolution. And the very reason, or one of the reasons why I put exponentially distributed random variables, is that you can convince yourself that this is then a simple continuous time Markov jump process. And so you can write on the generator for this, which will be sort of an operator which is acting on functions on configuration space. So the configuration space are just sort of, all particle configurations, and then the usual notation in the probabilistic literature would be to write it like this. So here I have the configuration before the jump, after the jump, the occupation at neighboring size j and j plus 1 are interchanged. But of course, I don't do this all the time. The condition under which I can do this is that the side j must be occupied, so this is why I put the eta j, and this side must be empty, so that's 1 minus eta j. Okay. Now, I guess sort of people coming more from condensed matter, it would be more convenient to think of this as a spin Hamiltonian, so let me just do this little exercise. This one is by definition always sort of, I mean, its eigenvalues will be in the left half plane, and so the Hamiltonian usually, one thinks of the spectrum going to plus infinity, so let me write minus L equal to H, and then from this thing you can figure out what is the corresponding spin Hamiltonian. So now we have Pauli spin matrices. And you see two parts. I mean, this is sort of the symmetric part. That's the usual. There's a minus sign here, so this part by itself would be the usual Heisenberg ferromagnet. So these are now, the sigmas are now Pauli spin matrices, right? I mean, they're really operators now. And then, of course, you must get at 5, and because things are going in one side, I mean, you will have a non-symmetric Hamiltonian. So this is why the I is sitting here, and then I have an XY coupling. So if somebody is sort of an expert in quantum spin chains, I mean, this kind of chain will look very familiar. All what has happened is that, you know, the coupling constant, which usually you would think to be real, has been sort of analytically continued to I. Okay? So you might say that the problem which we are looking at is sort of roughly on the scale of looking at one-dimensional spin systems. Okay? I mean, I think that's actually a pretty fair comparison. And so, I mean, now you look at your toolbox, and one of them, of course, is there's the beta ansatz, and indeed, I mean, the beta ansatz works very nicely for this system, and you can compute various quantities. I don't want to go into details here, but for instance, you can analyze the spectrum of this operator in quite some detail. The eigenvalues will not be on the real axis, but there's an I here, and the sigma y also contains an I. It's a real operator. I mean, just like sitting over here. I mean, real functions are mapped to real functions, and therefore the eigenvalues come in pairs. It's also a normal operator, so I mean, you can use sort of standard theory, and what you find is that it's sort of the spectrum on the swing of size n. So now I'm doing a somewhat different setup than what I proposed here. Now I'm just thinking of putting a ring, and I have n sides along the ring, and I put periodic boundary conditions. So this is the case which is typically analyzed when you use the beta ansatz. And what you find is that, by definition, I mean, the ground state has always energy zero. And in fact, the ground state is explicit. So that's a little bit different from the usual beta ansatz, where, you know, the very task is sort of computing the ground state. This is simple here. I mean, the ground state, you know, explicitly. It's just sort of the ground state. The ground state is not really perturbed by this term here, right? I mean, so the ground state is just the ground state of the ferromagnetic spin chain, which we know explicitly. Anyway, so I fix the occupation, so that in the magnetic language would mean that I fix the magnetization, and then I can compute, for this sector, I can compute the energies, and what I find is sort of typically spectrum like this. This has been studied in great detail by now, and one of the important information is that the spectral gap goes like n to the minus 3/2, which is in perfect accordance with the Kadar-Parisi-Sang analysis. Okay? If you look at the very upper half of the spectrum, then you find the gap which goes like 1 over n. So this seems to indicate that up here, maybe there is actually some conformal field theory floating around. But you know, for our problem, I mean, this is totally uninteresting. I mean, that's a very short time behavior, and I mean, nobody could care less. Right? But you know, if somebody just looks at this as an abstract operator, I mean, then you could might as well look up here, right? I mean, that's fine. Okay. All right. Now, the beta ansatz is beautiful. The main problem with the beta ansatz is that, as everybody knows in this audience here, it's very difficult to compute correlations. And for this very particular model, I mean, despite the fact that we have enormous information about the spectrum, nobody has so far succeeded to compute on the basis of the beta ansatz any kind of more refined statistical information. So what we get from the beta ansatz is the scaling exponent, but not more. Okay. So that's a limitation, and you know, maybe that's a question of time. People have sort of used all kind of techniques, also numerical techniques, which are borrowed from the theory of quantum spin chains, and that works actually quite well. But it's a numerical method. So here I want to get more to these exact things. Okay, now we come to the...
Can I comment?
Yes.
Although it's a digital Heisenberg model.
Yes.
Not actually a Heisenberg model because of this part.
No, that's what I emphasize. I mean, it's only this part which is the ferromagnetic Ising model, right? And then there comes this, the crucial perturbation. I mean, that makes the whole growth process, yes.
Okay. And, because of this, we're going to look to physics is entirely different.
Yes.
And therefore, computation correlation functions, that was the problem with Delphi, the problem with Delphi.
Yeah.
Level of difficulties.
Well, but you know, I mean, you, okay, yes, okay, yeah, I agree, yes.
Without I, many configurations, which would not be cancelled in real atomic here, will cancel.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. I mean, on the other side, I mean, you know, the beta ansatz, I mean, looks of course, because the eigenvalues are so different, I mean, looks a little bit different, but this is a detail which I can discuss later. Okay, so now I want to come to the random matrix theory part, and so let me just quote, I mean, the result of Johansson on this model. So what he does, I mean, so you look again, I mean, at the height at the origin, so that's, so you're always looking at this quantity, and I subtract the asymptotic mean. I don't subtract the mean of this function. I subtract what it would be for very large time. So that's c times t. C was the gross velocity. So here I'm. So here I still have the picture, right? I mean, this is my h. Okay. Silver means that I'm looking at the origin. So I'm looking at this quantity here. Okay. Okay, and then we argued that it should be of size t to the 1/3, so I divide by t to the 1/3, this should be of order 1, and then you ask what is the probability under this model that this quantity is less or equal to s, so that's the cumulative probability distribution function, and then you do the scaling limit, which in this case just means that we're looking at the large time limit. Okay, and what Johansson proves is that this quantity actually converges to a limit. And after they have done a rather lengthy and complicated analysis, they were extremely surprised that the distribution function, which they found is actually already present in the literature, it has been obtained in the sort of previously in a totally different context by Tracy and Widom, and therefore this distribution function is called the beta equal to 2 Tracy Widom distribution function. I want to give you a formula for this distribution function, which sort of emphasizes, I mean, you know, this is related to Poincaré equations, things like this, which I don't want to go into, but I want to give you a formula which sort of is really structurally informative. So this distribution function can be written as an infinite dimensional determinant. So here's and this, the operators which are sitting here, they're living over this sort of Hilbert space over the real line, and so here's just a unit operator, and here I have a product of I could leave this out anyway. So here's a product of infinite dimensional projectors, and they are actually very easily defined. I mean, so the first projection is simply the projection. I take a wave function psi and I simply cut off everything which is below s, right? I mean, so this is the theta function. So that's certainly an infinite dimensional projection, a rather simple one. Now this one is slightly more complicated. What I have to do is I have to look at the area operator, which is simply a quantum Hamiltonian with a linear potential. And this p here projects onto all states with a negative energy. Okay? So that's another infinite dimensional projection. You see this has continuous spectrum, which goes all the way to minus infinity to plus infinity. So I'm summing over sort of a countable set of linearly independent states, and therefore, I mean, both projections have infinite dimension. However, they're sufficiently orthogonal so that this operator is actually quite well behaved. I mean, you know, sort of has discrete spectrum, has sort of eigenvalues which accumulate sufficiently fast at zero. So this product is actually, which is sort of quite well behaved. And therefore, there's no problem in defining this infinite dimensional determinant. And the assertion is that what comes out when you do this complicated computation, what comes out in the limit is exactly this expression. Okay? The fact that this can be then written as a solution of a certain differential equation with respect to S, that's sort of a minor point here. I mean, the real thing which comes out of the analysis is this infinite dimension determinant. Okay? And now let me give you the random matrix interpretation. I mean, this is sort of the work of Tracy and Widom. So they were, of course, not concerned with the kind of things which we're studying here. I mean, they just look completely sort of a standard problem in random matrices. You take n by n complex Hermitian matrices, and you postulate sort of a Gaussian-like distribution, which is e to the minus trace a squared, and I smuggled in the 1 over n because that's sort of the natural scaling in our case. I mean, if you look in the literature, you will not find this factor. Okay. which makes things look a little bit ugly. Anyway, so the reason why I put this in is I want to make sure that when I look now at the eigenvalues of such a matrix, that their typical distance is of order 1. I mean, that's sort of ensured by this factor 1 over n. Well, okay, now you have this distribution of matrices, so you might ask, what is the induced distribution of eigenvalues? They are sort of, if you have a distance 1, so since I have n of them at some cutoff which is of size n, things must sort of, cannot be any further eigenvalue, and you all know that if I look at the density of these eigenvalues, they will satisfy this Wigner semicircle law. And what Tracy and Widom ask, I guess sort of also more or less independently Forrester, but sort of Tracy and Widom sort of really sort of worked out in detail all sort of the mathematical properties and so anyway, so what you can ask is, you could ask yourself, what is the location of the largest eigenvalue relative to the asymptotic edge? So this n is computed on, I mean, this prefactor is computed on the basis of the Wigner semicircle law, and then you're asking yourself, what is the relative distance of the largest eigenvalue from the asymptotic edge? And what you find is, first of all, that this distance is of order n to the, I mean, this arrow is actually pointing the right way. I mean, it's this thing here, which I, okay, let me do this correctly. I mean, this is not going here, it's this distance, which is, okay, I'm looking at the distance relative to the edge, okay? And what you find is that, first of all, it's of size n to the 1/3, and then if you look at the random amplitude, it's given exactly by this F2 Tracy-Widom distribution, okay? Okay, so this is the 99 result, which sort of is rather striking, because on one side you have a gross model and you do a long computation, and at the end of the day you arrive at something which is very well known from random matrix theory. And I hope by the end of these lectures you will have at least an idea where this comes from. Let me show you a plot of the Tracy distribution.
Okay, but you don't explain yet how does this gross.
Not yet. You have to be a little bit patient. I mean, I'm still trying to. Yeah, no. I haven't said anything. I just sort of want to. At the moment, I'm still giving you the overall picture. Okay. You see, the reason why. Okay. So now maybe I should say one word. I mean, you're completely right in asking. You see, the point is that, despite, you know, these things, I mean, it's not like what you usually think of a mapping. You know, mapping, you think you take a function, you take its Fourier transform, and then you map something to something else. The Van der matrices, it's a much more subtle type of procedure, and therefore, you know, I just cannot do in three words tell you, you know, how the Van der matrices in these models actually appear, okay? So that's the reason why I'm sort of so slow and not coming to the point, okay? Okay, so here's the plot of the Tracy-Widom distribution. I guess it's the logarithm of the probability. And so you see, it's not centered, because by emphasis we did not center it. It's a little bit shifted to the negative side, and it has tails which go like e to the minus x cubed and e to the minus x 3/2 with certain prefactors which I always put to 1 here. And it's these tails which I alluded to, which you can get through the large deviation results. And then, of course, I mean, this precise shape you have to compute from the formula.
In terms of original model, the distribution function equal?
What is?
What is that in terms of original model?
It's always the one in the original model. I mean, so let me do it again. I mean, so the H, so you have. You have this asymptotic shape, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm looking along this direction. Okay, so this is my h at time t. Okay, now let me make a plot again. What this is? I mean, so this is t. I mean, this is just a scalar function, right? H of t, and so this is fluctuating. So it has roughly a linear slope, and relative to this linear slope, it's fluctuating like this, right? Okay, and now I'm looking at large times, and at large times, I'm asking myself, what are the fluctuations relative to this, to the linear slope? So I'm taking out the drift, if you want so. And I'm asking myself, so you know, at this particular time t here, you know, I repeat many times experiments, I will see a certain distribution. Okay, so if I plot the distribution at this particular time, what I'm postulating is that what you see. I mean, so now imagine that you do this numerically. So you run the system 10,000 times, and you're plotting the distribution. So what I'm doing here is I'm plotting here the probability for H CT, right? And so this will be centered at CT, and then I see some distribution which sort of looks like this. And the width of this distribution is T to the 1 cell. Okay? And what you see on the plot is simply the logarithm of this probability distribution. So if it would be a perfect parabola on this plot, then I would see here a Gaussian distribution, but it's not a perfect parabola, so I see this non-Gaussian distribution.
So X is H over T to the power 1 cell.
What is X? You were worried about what I call here X. Yeah, okay. So this is that's a variable which appears in this probability distribution.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so now we have seen what this is. Okay, now the next question is it accidental? I mean, or maybe it's just for that very particular quantity you see Van der Matrix quantities popping up. And you might think it's accidental, right? I mean, so it's not any deep connection, but it's sort of, you know, I mean, like other things in life. I mean, there are certain sort of accidents happening without any deeper reason, right? I mean, this could very well be the case. Okay, so now let me convince you that in fact that's not true. And I'm referring here to a very recent paper by Borodin Ferrari et al. I mean, this was sort of anticipated, but they sort of really work out all the details. You can sort of look this up in the net. And so the idea is, I guess what was sort of asked already several times here, the idea is that let's probe this kind of connection by not changing the model, but just changing sort of the initial conditions, right? And one thing which computer simulation people always do is rather than looking at this cone, which sort of looks a little bit artificial, it's just sort of done for the purpose of the analysis, just start with something which is a flat substrate. I mean, what else should you think? Okay, so here I do with a flat substrate, and the best I can do is I just sort of take my height to be up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down, all the way to infinity. Okay? And now I let run the simulation. I mean, I run the model. I mean, and it's the same again. I mean, you know, at each one of these sides independently, I deposit a square. And then once I have deposited, you know, I put here another square, and then here there's another closed time I deposit, etc., etc. Right? I mean, so the rules are always the same. I mean, I'm not changing the rules. It's always the same model. Okay. Now, then of course, there's no reason to have any curvature. In fact, in this case, indeed, it will sort of grow, and you know, for a long time, I will see this sort of displaced by something which is proportional to t, and then there will be statistical fluctuations. Well, now we look again at our height above the origin. That was always a quantity. It has a linear term. I leave out the non-universal factors. Again, it has a typical size of order t to the 1 third, so it will look exactly like this one here. However, this random amplitude will turn out to remember the initial conditions. Rather than seeing the distribution which I just described here, you will see something which I call here Xi flat, and the Xi flat is the beta equal 1 crazy rhythm distribution. So this means that in this particular case, actually, I again have the connection to the Van der matrices. However, I see a different distribution. You see, it's universal in terms of the 1 third, but the flat thing sort of actually remembers, I mean, has a different random amplitude. Okay. And the way how the beta equal 1 appears is just exactly as before. Namely, what I do is I look at Van der matrices with the same distribution what I discussed before. The only difference is that now I stipulate that A is a real Hermitian matrix rather than a complex Hermitian matrix. Okay? This will not change the Wigner semicircle law, but it will change the fluctuations of the largest eigenvalue. Okay? So from this I conclude that the answer must be no, in the sense that, you know, it cannot be an accident. And let me show you again sort of plots of these things, I mean, so that you get at least some sort of feeling. It's sort of, again, I'm plotting here the probability distribution, the logarithm of the probability distribution. This is the one which we just discussed. I mean, this was the corner growth. That's this one here. If I do what corresponds sort of in the particle language to 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, I get a somewhat displaced distribution. I mean, it's not so sort of drastically different, but anyway, it's certainly not the same.
Again, it's cubic semi-cubic.
Hmm?
It's always cubic semi-cubic tails.
The tails are always the same, but what is changing are the prefactors, but the powers are the same on both sides. Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, now you can sort of do another experiment. You can say, well, look, I mean, if I start with initial condition, which was sort of 0, 1, 0, 1, so... So I can start with... So this is what I studied, right? I mean, this kind of initial condition. Okay, so I fill up like, okay, terrible drawing. Anyway, so I fill up like this, okay. Another thing what you could do is you can just imagine that you start with a random walk initially, right? I mean, that's also actually a rather natural distribution. So you know, rather than making this periodic, I mean, you know, I'd randomly construct my initial conditions according to a random walk, right? And then maybe I go up, down, up, etc. Right? And of course, you know, you can sort of do the same rules. I mean, here are my quo sites. You fill them after an exponential waiting time, and then things are just going upwards, right? So this is the simulation of this one. Now you get something which is no longer, has never been studied within random matrix theory per se. So that's this quantity over here. But of course, now in the meantime, we understand these things much better, and we can construct the corresponding ensemble of random matrices, which would exactly reproduce this object. Okay? But it's a little bit more complicated construction. It's no longer very natural in terms of random matrices. I mean, random matrix people would never come up with this thing. Okay? But I mean, once you know what the thing is, I mean, of course, then you can somehow sort of, you know, reconstruct this object within random matrix theory. Okay, so where are we in our program? Matrix value diffusion. Uh-huh. Let's see. Okay, so let me. Go a little bit.
Is there an initial condition which gives you red equal 4?
Excuse me?
I mean, is there initial conditions which give you red equal 4?
Yes. Well, I can tell you. I've come to a picture. Yes, there also. In fact, I mean, you know, there was one thing here on this thing. I mean, you know, you might wonder now, you know, what is universal and not universal. So let me just tell you that the assertion is that whenever you see a piece of your surface which has a non-zero curvature, then you see the beta equal to 2 case, okay? And that's, I mean, at least of all examples which you studied, there will be no exception. However, whenever you have a flat piece of your surface, I mean, then you have to look in much more detail. So if I see something like this, you see you will get some distribution over here, you will get another distribution exactly when I'm looking exactly at the junction of the flat piece and the bounded piece, and here I will see always the base of it and beta equal to 2.
So,
no, the curvature, the sign, that's like in the Kada-Parisi sign. I mean, the sign of the curvature is unimportant. The point is that it must be a non-zero curvature. If it's a zero curvature, I have to sort of reanalyze the situation. I have to think about it. All right. Now, let's see. Something missing here. Let's see, which way do I want to do that? Ah, yeah, okay. It's coming much later. Okay, all right, okay. So now let me spend, let's see. How should we do this with the break? Let me start a little bit with, I mean, let's just take 5 minutes on this matrix value diffusion and then continue, okay? So now I sort of switch completely. I mean, so now I want to sort of start from the random matrix side, and I want to convince you what is sort of the picture behind this random matrices, but from behind this growth process, but perfect only sort of from the random matrix side. I'm not telling you yet about the connection, okay? And it turns out that if you sort of look at isolated quantities like this height above the origin, then it's very difficult to really understand the connection to random matrices. I mean, of course, you can sort of write down in formula, but you don't have any feeling why these quantities come up. However, if you decide to sort of enlarge your vision slightly, namely, actually really go to the full space-time picture, then things become very transparent. And so this is what I want to do in this next little section. And so this I called matrix value diffusion, which goes back to Dyson. And in the meantime, there has been sort of quite a number of results. So let me just sort of explain you what it is. So first of all, I start with the matrix value Brownian motion. And now the time is the Brownian motion time, which is totally different from the Gross time. I mean, so I'm using the same symbols because we are used to it, but it's really a different thing. Okay, and so how this, and I want to, so this this is n by n complex Hermitian matrix, And the way I want to, I've enforced that this thing has, I'm looking at the TUE case, so it should be invariant under unitary transformation. So if I look at this Brownian motion, and if I make a unitary transformation, then they should be the same in distribution. Okay? And then you can work it out in a specific basis. So here I'm now taking the derivatives of this object. This will be delta correlated and sort of maximal symmetric. So this is, if you sort of want to think in terms of defining correlations, you can also think in terms of this equation. But that's sort of somehow the more transparent one. Well, once we have such a matrix value Brownian motion, we can write on the usual kind of stochastic differential equation, which we have seen during this workshop many times, but mostly we were thinking about scalar equations. Now I'm just thinking about matrix valued equation, and so here if I'm writing down sort of a simple Langevin equation, here's the force and here's the driving time derivative of the Brownian motion. Let me not write it as a proper stochastic differential equation, so I kept the ddt over here. But you all know, I mean, we have been well prepared for this thing, okay, so. Now you can ask yourself, what is the stationary measure of this equation? Well, it's sort of like what you would naively think. It's just the exponential of the potential. And since I have matrices, I still have to take the trace. So this is the stationary measure. So I can imagine that initially I start with this distribution, and then I just let it run. And then, of course, it will be something which is stationary in time. So I'm looking.
It's normalizable.
Hmm?
Assume that it's normalizable.
Well, I guess, I'm assuming here that V sort of increases so that it has, that's right. I mean, so the partition function should be finite, yes. Okay, so then I can make this stationary. So this is what I mean, I can take other initial conditions, but let me just, for the purpose of this discussion, let me assume that I'm looking here at the stationary case, okay? Well, so if I solve this differential equation, at every time t, I will have an n by n complex Hermitian matrix. That's A of t. Okay? And of course, this matrix has an eigenvalues, and I denote them by lambda n sub t. I order them sort of in reverse. I mean, the top one is lambda 1, and then I'm going down, which is lambda n. Okay? That's easy enough. These are continuous functions of time. And you can ask yourself, what is the induced dynamics on the eigenvalues? Okay. Now this is sort of a standard computation which we have seen already during this workshop. You give a time t, you give yourself a matrix, and then you have a small increment, which of course comes from this part and from this part, and then you basically have to do expand to second order, and then you have to perturbations here, we up to second order, and then you have to collect terms, and this is what you get. So here I'm writing down the equation for lambda j, so that's the j's eigenvalue. It has the first order part, so that's the dd part if you want, so which is this piece here, and which is this piece here, and these are now just standard independent real-valued Brownian motions. Okay? And then there will be a second order part because I have to expand to second order. And what you see here is simply the formula which everybody knows from second-order perturbations theory. It's sort of 1 over, matrix value squared divided by the resolvent. So if I write this in terms of the eigenvalues, you get the difference of this thing. And I carefully put here the sign. The thing is actually repulsive. So that's what Dyson liked very much. I mean, according to his equation, these eigenvalues actually repel. I mean, that's for him was sort of an explanation why you see level repulsion. So this is the equation which governs the eigenvalues. And let's see. So let me put just this one up here, and let me do the next thing then after the break. The thing which I want to sort of emphasize is that, we heard so many talks about SLE, and you know that what matters in SLE is the question whether kappa is less than 4 or larger than 4, and so you carefully look at this thing, and of course we have here different normalizations, but what you find is that the value of kappa which you have here is actually corresponds to less than 4. And therefore by a very similar argument, except for the fact now I have sort of not just one single diffusions, but sort of diffusing in n-dimensional space, you can do a similar argument, and you discover that the eigenvalues never touch. If I start changing this coefficient, of course, at some point this will be no longer true. But I mean, for our case, that's well defined. And so the picture what you should have is that I have this eigenvalue sort of happily running around, and they never touch. So what's happening is that the picture which you should see is sort of you have here T, and here you have these lambdas, and they're just sort of fluctuating stochastically, okay? But there's no time instant where they touch, so they're always nicely separated. I mean, the touching has probability zero. So I think that's a good point to stop, maybe.
It's not the SLE curves.
Well, no, these are not SLE curves. I mean, these are just solutions of these stochastic differential equations, which I've written down here. This is somewhat singular repulsive term, right? I mean, these are just the solutions of these differential equations. Okay. So maybe for those people who know, I mean, this is what in the language random matrices are called multi-matrix model, because if you write down, you know, sort of this distributions explicitly in terms of matrices, then you see that you sort of get along the time axis sort of coupled matrices, and therefore it's called a multi-matrix model. I mean, but you can just think of them as sort of matrix-valued functions. I mean, that's the same thing. Okay, so let me stop here, and then we continue afterwards. Well, I mean, you see, this is no. I mean, you see what Shankardi had. That's right. I mean, when Shankardi had, he used this. I mean, Shankardi used this process to drive. He used this process. I mean, he was on the circle, so there's nothing like this. I mean, there's just these objects, but he was on the circle, and he used this to drive SLE. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, after all, you know, if you take this away, I mean, then it looks very similar to what you would have in SLE. You can think of this as a driving process for SLE.
Yeah, yeah.
You see, I mean, the usual driving is just sort of corresponds to that sort of multiple SLE. That's right, yeah. You know, of course, there's, so in that sense, there's no connection because, I mean, it just happens this, you know, the driving process which John likes in his SLE sort of also reappears here.
But if you take the last of the bunch of SLE, multiple SLE, you should get the same.
But you know, it's on the level of the driving process for SLE. I mean, then there, you know, you could still ask the question, if I then look at the corresponding SLE image, I mean, sort of the complex map, which comes sort of as a solution of the Loewner equation with this driving force, I mean, you know, how that would look like. I mean, you see the point is, yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I mean, it's certainly correct. I mean, that you know, when you look at the last eigenvalue, then that's sort of something which is an input into mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right, yeah. But, I mean.
I don't think there's anything between
the relation. No, I don't. The point is that, I mean, you know, it's more, I mean, these things are much more, I mean, if I see about, you know, they're much more connected to sort of like.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, the SLE really, you know, uses this sort of as an input. I mean, then, you know, I mean, so in that sense, you know, I mean, but whatever you get, then, you know, by looking then at sort of
solutions of the Loewner
with this input, I mean, that's sort of a different issue somehow. Mm. I mean, it has certainly nothing to do with the Krauss. Yeah.
No, the Krauss will be a somewhat different
topic. Yeah, I mean. I guess I'm sharing the fate of ABC.
Yeah.
Sort of.
was much less, but that's good.
That's okay.
The problem you experience.
Yeah, the worst talk is the one where people walk out and say, yeah, I understood at work. Yeah. If they understand something,
what is the potential you have to choose?
Well, I mean, so
what does it depend on?
Well, I mean, at the moment, of course, the only thing we should require is that in precondition in terms of the position function is fine, right? Now, if you want to make the connection to that's sort of coming on the next chance. If you want to make the connection to the post, see what happens is that the post is actually connected. This is sort of what by that Johnson found to the largest eigenvalue. Therefore, in this language, it will correspond to the top line, and therefore you have to sort of do proper scaling of your confining potential. So the specific form of it's sort of a semi-classic limit, if you want. So you see, what I want to have is I want to make sure that the density of states according to this distribution sort of scales properly, so that asymptotically, I get a well-defined density of states. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be even a semi-circular. You see, I mean, of course, if I take the standard case would be to take here just a Gaussian, so I take a square, right? I mean, this would be the standard case. Then, of course, you get usually being a semi-circular. But the kind of things I'm looking at are actually, I mean, and that's sort of useful remark. I mean, they're actually sort of rather independent of which potential I'm choosing. I mean, the only thing which I need, must make sure that I get a well-defined density. So that requires a particular scaling.
For large A.
For large or N. For the large. Yeah. And this
N is
N is sort of the scaling parameter. So yeah. I'm looking at large and, I mean, very high dimensional matrices, and what you want to make sure is that if I look at the distribution of eigenvalues, I mean, that's sort of the density of space, and that should, I mean, I have to scale the potential in such a way that this is a double. So it has to be a potential which is sort of increasing, but the specific form is actually not necessary. And the point is you see that the largest eigenvalue sort of plays a special role. I mean, the eigenvalues which are in bulk, I mean, they are sort of distance one apart, and they, of course, they sort of, might be a certain detail. I guess what I want to say is that there are special points which maybe you have to look at, and they're potentially actually just never the precise. But what we are doing with this ice form of potential is actually an important economic stuff.
And I didn't understand the connection what you said about the multi-matrix model. So where do the multi-matrices come from here? I know, of course, if you have an IC model, for example, you get it with two matrices.
Suppose we are in an Gaussian case, and you think that rather than solving a differential equation, you would want to write out your probability distribution at discrete time points,
Okay.
So that's called, let's call this matrix A sub, and that's called the K of J, right? But J is not a discrete variable.
The time variable,
yeah. I mean, not discrete. Now, how would you write on, let's think about the Gaussian case, how would you write on sort of the solution of this differential equation, right? No, I mean, you would write it down as V to the minus summation over J, summation over J. A base of H A plus 1. I mean, maybe there's some coefficients which I'm leaving out here, H A square. Right? Mm-hmm. And then there will be still summation of some potential. Right? Yeah. So this is sort of the explicit solution of the discretized. And this is sort of what people, so then they say, now I have rather than the distribution of single matrices, I have the distribution of many matrices.
Oh, okay.
And this is where the multi matrix comes from. So here I have sort of, it's just a question of language, but here sort of I'm thinking of primates. Discretized version. And it's in this form, which has been sort of many studies.
Right.
Yeah. just a time discrepancy.
There's no discrepancy. And are these people making use of the Green Miller approach to make these models and people would study this?
Well, not really. So, I mean, you know, I think they'll be hungry, but you know, somehow there are kind of questions which these people are asking in the multivariate model, or somebody is trying to put the questions and try to answer if you want to make a connection to the post model. I mean, you know, it's an equation that, you know, it's a priori, it's the same model. Right? But then the question which you're asking is very different. Yeah. And so the point is that while you know, this question about large sign value, which has been asked before, you know, the questions of what is the large sign value of sort of such a multi matrix, and so on, was not never asked by people doing sort of multiplication and multi matrix. I mean, it's just sort of, you know, it's just sort of a question of, you sort of come from a somewhat different position context, and therefore you're asking different questions. And so that's essentially.
Shall we start? Okay, well, the rest, some people are coming, okay. Oh, they've picked nice breakfast here. Mm-hmm. I missed it. Okay, so let's see. So, okay. So now we want to do, okay, so. Okay, so what I hope you understood from the result of Bike-Dive Johansson, and what is of importance is the largest eigenvalue, right? So you see what was shown in within the matrix theory is that if you look at the largest eigenvalue and if you take n very large, then of course it will be displaced by n. I mean, because we're looking at the edge of the spectrum. But then the typical distance away from the edge will be n to the 1/3 times the random amplitude, which was this Vasey Widom distribution. Okay, and if you sort of look back, I mean, you know, we took the potential A squared, sort of, which is a harmonic potential, but you can take also some other potential, which is sort of increasing at infinity. And then if you sort of look at your formulas, I mean, then you have to scale this particular potential with n. So, I mean, maybe I should not go into details here, but let me just put here the quadratic potential. Then you see here A squared divided by n squared, and I multiply by n, so this gives 1 over n A squared. This is sort of the one which I had for the trace of Widom. I mean, so this was trace. I had e to the minus 1 over n trace a squared. Okay. Well, of course, now we don't have just one single eigenvalue, but we have many lines. So what you could do is you could look at these many lines, and of course now I would look at the top line, which was the lambda 1, which depends now on t, and you might ask yourself what is the statistics of this top line. Well, that's not so hard to figure out, actually. You see, we know already that the amplitudes in this direction are like n to the 1/3. And since everything is driven by Brownian motion, you might think that the rescaling in this direction should be like what you do for Brownian motion. Namely, you should look at times of order n to the 2/3. That's just the standard Brownian motion scaling, right? Well, if you do this, I put in here the top eigenvalue. I look at this sort of large scale here. I subtract the mean value. And this should be of order n to the 1/3. So I take here, scale this down by n, or multiply with n to the minus 1/3. Then I get sort of the scaled largest eigenvalue. And then I can take the limit as n goes to infinity. And this limit indeed exists as a random function. So these are now on both sides. I have random functions sitting. And the limiting object is what is called the airy process. So the airy process is a stochastic process as a function, a sort of real-valued stochastic process, and it's sort of the limiting, sort of the scaling limit of the top eigenvalue in this diffusion, in this matrix-valued diffusion processes. All right. So now we come to an even stronger. Okay. So now I want to show you the alternative construction. So this is sort of very important because it's this really how the link actually works to the gross model. So let me go back from the scaling. I mean that's something which comes up later on, again. But let me go back to fixed n and let me do an alternative construction of these statistics of these lines. Okay. And the alternative construction goes the following way. I mean, this has been sort of known for quite some time, but I mean, let me just sort of recall this. So now I'm doing a very different construction. I have n fixed, and I'm just looking at n independent random walks. So they're all driven by this Brownian motion. They're all sitting in the same external potential, but they're totally independent. Okay, and I run them stationary. So this is a confining potential. I mean, they're flattening back and forth, but they run according to the stationary diffusion process. Okay, and of course, if I do it like this, there will be plenty of crossings. I mean, because there's just no reason why you know x1 and x2 should not cross. I mean, they will cross plenty of times. All right. Okay. Now, what I want to do is I want to condition this on non-crossing. And the way how the sort of proper construction goes, and let me just sort of do this because otherwise maybe it's not completely clear what I mean by this non-crossing. So what I'm plotting here, that's not a very good guess. Okay, anyway, so this so I want to what I want to do is the following. So I want to first fix a time window which goes from minus t up to t, and then I'm drawing these curves here. So these are these lines as random lines, and then I simply throw away all those configurations which in the time window from minus t to t cross, and the rest I normalize again to 1. Okay? Now of course as t becomes large, you know, this sort of huge normalization factor, but that's just like always in statistical mechanics, right? I mean sort of partition functions sort of increase exponentially and will be the same thing here. Okay? Well then I take then I get sort of these random walks up here or these diffusion processes conditioned on non-crossing in the time interval from minus t up to t, and then I take the limit as t goes to infinity. Okay? And the assertion is that in this way I get exactly the statistics of the eigenvalues of this diffusion matrix, of this matrix value diffusion process. So I get exactly the statistics of eigenvalues as governed by this kind of stochastic differential equation which I've written down here. Okay, so I get exactly the correct statistics of this thing here. Yeah. Question? What did I do? No, I'm taking the limit as the time window becomes infinity. Oh, for not jointly for all t and all j.
You have to wait to see this one.
Why is this the same?
You use a guessing of
Wait a second. So what is the question? So you have to show me which part of the formula is confusing.
He's asking for the reason why this is.
Oh, the reason. Oh, sorry. Okay, I just didn't get this acoustically. No, okay. Well, the reason is I think it's a computation. I mean, I'm afraid I cannot sort of satisfy this in two words. But I mean, the way how you do this actually is that just look at the case n equal to 2. And then basically for n equal to 2, I mean, you make a very explicit computation which tells you that this identity is correct. And then from this, I mean, you know, sort of, it's an explicit computation. I'm afraid that there's no way of really.
So you think that instead of getting repulsive term, singular term, 1 over lambda I,
yes, you condition.
Basically, just a condition.
Exactly.
And statistically, it's the same.
It's the same. That's correct. Okay. So this, if you think statistically, if you sort of think in a statistical mechanics language, then what this amounts to is that I take sort of independent lines and I add perfect entropic repulsion. I just let them not cross at all. This is sort of, you know, if you would think in terms of statistical mechanics. But the assertion is that, you know, if I start with the random matrices, I just get exactly the same thing.
Is this a sort of a theorem?
It's a theorem, yes. And it's an explicit computation. I mean, it's sort of, I don't think there's sort of an easy way to like a 5 minutes demonstration. I mean, you really have to go through the formulas.
To go to random matrices, there is an important parameter beta.
Yes. This is beta equal to 2. No, the beta
is...
This is special for beta equal to 2. It's not true for any other beta.
For any other beta?
It's not true. Well, there is something, but then I have it, it's more complicated. You see, then you are sort of in the realm of Kolodziejczyk-Sutherland models, and then the pure entropic repulsion is not enough. I have to add sort of a potential which goes like 1 over x squared. Then this construction is still correct. So yes, I mean, if you have beta equal to 2 is sort of the special case where this quadratic potential, I mean, the 1 over x squared potential in the Kolodziejczyk-Sutherland model actually vanishes, and I have pure entropic repulsion. So this construction is very special, beta equal to 2. This is true for any n. No, so here this is a fixed n result. But what I have to do is I have to condition sort of, you know, along the whole time axis. Otherwise, you know, I really have to take this time window to infinity. I mean, the time window where I do the conditioning. I mean, the conditioning I must do everywhere, right? I mean, otherwise it's not true. But n is fixed. I mean, n you can take n equal to 2. I mean, that's fine. Okay? So now, you see, we get, we expect a stronger result. I mean, you know, if this analogy to the Van der Matrix theory is actually correct, then what we should get is not only this, so let me see, I have to draw my, here's still the standard picture, you see. So you see, what I did before is I looked at the statistics above the origin. So, you know, this was sort of my j-axis, and I looked at these statistics. But if this connection to Van der matrices is correct, I mean, then you might guess that, you know, I get actually a much stronger result, namely I can actually determine the exact surface statistics, not only at one given point, but at many points simultaneously. Okay? And so this is what I've written down here in a formula. So now I'm looking, now I set the scaling, so the way I have to glide, was the distance I have to look sidewards is t to the 2/3. I mean, these fluctuations are still t to the 1/3, so I multiply with t to the minus 1/3, so this gives me something of order 1. I still subtract the minus t, and I'm looking sort of a small distance on the macroscopic scale away from the origin. Okay? And then the assertion should be that this should be the same as the top eigenvalue of this matrix valued diffusion process, but not quite, because you see there's this net curvature, and therefore this net curvature actually still appears in the limit. So I have to displace this, sort of I have to bend this upwards by the factor x squared. And so this is just a check. I mean, if I make a quadratic approximation, then the profile looks like, so it's like t, because everything sort of scales with t, and x over t squared. I mean, so this is what the macroscopic profile will be for large times. And
this is an assumption.
No, this somebody proved that. I mean, you know, this is just the fact that I have a macroscopic profile, and that's true under very general conditions. And so now I'm, in order just to check whether I still get this term, what I did here is, I'm assuming that this profile on the macroscopic scale looks like x squared, then I put in the scaling factors, which are sort of t and 1 over t here. I mean, x has to be of order t on if I measure this in units of the lattice. And then I have the leading term, which I subtracted already. But then if I take the next term, you see I get x squared over t. And that's, of course, still invariant under Brownian motion scaling. Therefore, I expect to have this extra term here. Okay? And then I can come to this, which I was heading for all the time, namely, what is now the correspondence if I sort of make this somewhat more general assumption? What is sort of the correct correspondence between Gauss and Van der matrices? Well, if I look at the height function, then this should correspond to the largest eigenvalue, but not really just of, you know, sort of, I mean, of multi-matrix models. I mean, of this sort of matrix value diffusion. Okay. Now the Gauss time, which sort of is the quantity which goes here into infinity, would be the analog of the matrix dimension, which n goes to infinity. Okay. And what would be the j? I mean, the space coordinate in the Gauss process corresponds to the Brownian motion time t. Okay. And the question which you're asking all the time, I mean, why is this so, right? Okay. But this is sort of the correct analogy between the two problems. Now, before I continue, I want to sort of satisfy those people who think about other type of two-dimensional statistical mechanics problems, and I want to show you that there's actually another player in the game. A player on which I don't want to dwell because I have not enough time, but I want to at least explain you what is the third player in the game. And this is sort of the issue of how these type of problems are connected with other two-dimensional statistical mechanics problems. Okay? And in fact, the connection is quite cute, and it's something which you know, one might want to exploit further. So let me explain this. What is the third player? Now, the third player is, I picked here just one of them. I mean, could do other ones, but I picked one which I sort of most people would be familiar with. So I take the six vertex model, and for the purpose of drawing, what I want to do is I only draw the arrows which are pointing east and those which are pointing south, and the other ones are sort of basically defined through the ice rule, so I don't have to actually draw them. And so here I have my six possible vertices, okay. And then what I want to do is I want to look at the square domain, but not with periodic boundary conditions, but with what is called domain wall boundary conditions. And so these are our Dupuytren boundary conditions. I put in, so here's my square. Here I put in sort of incoming lines. I mean, they necessarily have to point east, so, but I don't have to indicate the orientation. So I draw lines here and I draw lines over here. So this is sort of plus boundary conditions if you want. So down here I put zero boundary conditions, so there's just empty, okay? And the way you can think about the statistical mechanics problem is that you want to do a tiling of the square with six different type of tiles, and the rules is that the lines always have to continue, they are never allowed to stop, right? So that's just a standard six vertex model with this particular boundary conditions, okay. Now the question is, where does the gross and the area and you know, sort of the largest eigenvalue, where does it appear? Well, it appears, okay, so let's first maybe look at, yeah, let's look maybe at sort of slightly larger simulation of this thing. I mean, just sort of to make sure that everybody understands what I'm seeing. So this is sort of would be a typical configuration under domain wall boundary conditions. And then what you can see is that there's sort of a regular region down here. There's another regular region down here. I mean, these are tiles number two. These are tiles number three. Here I have tiles number four. And here it's empty, so these are tiles number one in my units. Okay, and then you see in here sort of like a disordered region. And if you sort of look this way, you might think that these are not unlikely to our lines of the matrix valued diffusion. Okay?
Why? Because not all cross?
Well, they can cross here a little bit, but you see the point. Okay, so let me sort of put this up here, and so the claim, I mean, this is something which is not completely proved yet, but sort of the expectation is that if I look at this very last line, remember it's always the top line which one has to look at, it's this very last line which should have a statistics as sort of obtained from the multi-random matrix theory, okay? And why? Of course, these lines touch here, and they have a more complicated interaction, but it's sort of a short-range interaction. So somehow physically, one would say, well, you know, sort of entropic repulsion doesn't really make such big difference whether it's sort of short-range, you know, sort of or exactly sort of you know range zero. And of course, this line out here, I mean, this has a lot of freedom to fluctuate, and it will only have very few contacts, and therefore, maybe it's really true that this behaves like the airy process. Let me explain you what is the phase diagram.
So that's just an expectation.
Excuse me?
It's just an expectation.
Well, no. I want to be a little bit more precise. I mean, here I'm using sort of, I mean, when you look at these boundary conditions, you see that the weights are actually constrained. So the omega 1, omega 2 has to be equal to some number B, A, and C. And now I'm normalizing things in such a way that C is equal to 1, I guess, and then there is this parameter delta, which tells you the deviation from the free fermion point, which in this particular context is defined by this ratio here. And then the phase diagram, which one expects, you know, which sort of numerically looks rather convincing. I mean, of course, numerically people do not study such fine details, but at least the picture which I show you, I mean, that's sort of numerically, is that if you're in parameter space sort of inside this thing here, But you should see something similar what you have seen already. You know, there are these four ordered regions, and inside it's sort of disordered, and then there's a separating line, and this separating line should be governed by the largest eigenvalues of the multimatrix model. And the proof which is available is a proof by Johansson for the case delta equal to zero. That corresponds to the free fermion point. That's something which, of course, sort of is most accessible. And in this picture, that's this blue line here. And then if you see that one of these points of the blue line, then we are actually assured that the statistics of this outer boundary, I mean, the statistics of the domain which sort of separates the ordered region from the disordered region, is really in the scaling limit governed by the Airy process. And everything else is sort of numerically, and the point is that sort of the attraction becomes too strong between the lines, there's a transition, and rather seeing such kind of domain, I mean, you see sort of a separating wall which has basically fluctuations of order one, and down here this wall is sort of switched by 90 degrees, and down here you get sort of the antiferromagnetic phase, which in this language means that as you cross this line, you develop another facet in the middle of your domain. So you have these frozen regions, which corresponds to of sort of tiles or sort of, you know, sort of vertices of one particular type, and but now you get sort of another region, which is sort of basically sort of, you know, has a... Maybe there's another connection how to do it. But I mean, what I wanted to say is that whenever you see any one of these phase boundaries, most likely they are all have the same statistics as computed from the KPC equation, right?
Basically, you're saying
is
that normally, if you look at a picture there and you read it on space time,
yes.
Sometimes runs that way. Sort of service.
Yes.
And so you basically instead of flattening out with a six-vertex model on the other direction, you flatten it that way.
Yes. Yes, okay, but that's, yeah, okay. Okay, I completely agree, but I think this is, yes. I mean, that's also mapping, but I don't think that's the mapping which I'm talking about here. I mean, I think it's an also interesting mapping, yes. I think it was sort of the mapping which I used when I wrote down this sort of spin Hamiltonian, I mean, so, yes. I completely agree. I mean, you know, there are different ways of, I mean, the six vertex model sort of appears in somewhat different angles, and I think one is the one which you are describing, and I think we have to discuss. I think I'm describing, sort of, you know, slightly differently. But anyway, I mean, okay. Okay, what I want to emphasize is that's one thing I still wanted to explain. So, because I mean, this is sort of physically presumably the most relevant case. You see, when you look at this picture, you can imagine that you think of this actually as the level lines of a surface, right? I mean, here's the surface zero, here it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And so it really describes sort of like a rounded crystal, and here I have the facet. And so what this is telling you is that a very good guess of how the edge of the facet, the edge which separates the facet and the rounded piece of the surface should be actually governed, should have the same statistics as the surface fluctuations predicted by KPC. Okay, so this also tells you somehow the connection to the usual sort of two-dimensional statistical mechanics models are there, but it's sort of, one looks sort of in a somewhat sort of unusual corner. I mean, this is sort of what usually you would not look at if you sort of want to think of more bulk type of phenomena. They have sort of logarithmic fluctuations. This line is more like, no, you should think of it locally more like a Brownian motion. I mean, globally it's different, but I mean, if I look at short distances, you know, still large compared to the lattice, but short compared to where I sort of see more detailed structure of the air reposes, I mean, then it looks like Brownian motion. So, you know, in that sense, they are fractal. No. It's always graph of a function. I mean, you know, if you look at like this, I mean, then it's always, you know, if you take this coordinate system, it's graph of a function.
So, isoline.
That's an isoline, no?
Yes,
it's isoline. Yeah, so this is a graph of a function. And it statistically looks like, locally, it looks like a Brownian motion. But then there are other. No. This is the time direction, so to speak. So, you know, it doesn't.
Just take it
as it is. No, I don't think so. I mean, you know, it just sort of runs down like here. I mean, it can never loop up something like, can it never do any loops? I mean, it's sort of directed. I mean, it can never go back. Okay. Excuse me? You mean the interactions between the lines? Well, I mean, you know, I mean this. I don't know how to prove that, but you know, what you see and what we expect with various arguments is that, of course, you know, these lines sort of have a contact interaction. But if I look at this one, then there are such a few contacts that it doesn't. I mean, you know, it for V-scales, of course, sort of, you know, the non-universal parameters, but the statistical properties are not really affected. But that's a guess. I mean, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then, of course, if I make the interaction really strong, then you get the phase transition to the you know, where I lose, you know, where this boundary really becomes sharp. I mean. That's right. Yeah. If it's well, Brownian motion.
Yeah.
It's not SLE. No. Okay. It would be nice if it's SLE. Okay. All right. Okay. So now, let's see. Okay. We don't have so much time, but now I sort of.
It is somehow related to SLE because it's a Gaussian field. And level lines of Gaussian field are related to SLE coupling of form, and those lines are somehow connected to this Gaussian field.
Okay, so the Gaussian field is somewhere in here, right? This is where you will see your SLE. I mean, what I want to say is that of the Gaussian free field, I mean, you see in here, right? I mean, this is sort of a Gaussian free field, and now I'm sort of looking at this funny border, right? I mean, so which of course is sort of, I mean, this is not covered by what Scott Sheffield is doing, right? I mean, you know, he's looking at the Gaussian free field and the continuum at it, and it's level line, but now I'm looking sort of at this funny boundary.
Just check.
Thing.
It might be a thing. Just check.
Okay. All right. Okay. Fine. Good. Okay. So now I come sort of, I guess, not so much time, but anyway. So I want to give you at least I want to explain you, you know. I mean, at the moment I just sort of displayed the picture. Now I want to explain you how you actually get the random matrices. And if you look at what I'm talking about, I mean, there's some obvious defect. You see, if I look at the multi-matrix model, I have many lines. After all, I have n of them, and I insisted that I want to look at the top one. That's fine. But if I look at the Gross process, I mean, you know, there's just this one single line. I mean, there's nothing else which I have. I mean, there's just nothing else. So the question is, I mean, where do these other lines come from? Right? I mean, you know, otherwise, I mean, how can I do the mapping? Okay, so you see what is missing is I have to turn this from a single line problem into a multi-line problem. Then I have a chance of somehow saying that the statistical properties of this multi-line problem is similar to the one which I get from the random matrices. Okay, but this is completely missing. So this is sort of the only part which I still would like to explain to you. I mean, where do the other lines come from? And this is what this RSK construction. Okay. Now, I could do it for the model which I explained, but it turns out that this is sort of, not so transparent, and therefore I want to look at the particular limit of this model, which if you want to, is sort of like a Poisson limit. And so let me sort of explain this here. It's transparency. Okay, so now I change the model slightly in the sense that I do a discrete update. So. In every time step, I say that I want to fill, sort of independently, I want to fill this side with probability p, and I don't fill it with probability 1 minus p. Okay, just do this independently. And then the next time step, I do this simultaneously for all momentary Gross sides. Okay. Well, you can sort of convince yourself that Okay, so this means that if I'm going to the directed polymer, then this sort of random energies now will have a geometric distribution. You know, I've sort of k times I do not fill, and then finally I fill. So this is sort of the probability distribution which I get for my waiting times. And you can see from this formula that if I take the limit p going to 0, then this sort of under proper rescaling goes to the exponential. So that's what we discussed all the time. And now I want to take the opposite limit where p goes to 1, which is also the Poisson limit, which means that, you know, I sort of started to count here from 0. So that means that most of the time I get 0, and then once in a while I get a few ones, and then the, you know, the twos I can already forget. So you should think about in this limit, you should think about waiting times, which I mean, most of the time they are 0, and then once in a while I have a 1. And only very, very rarely, I have somewhere out here, I have a 2. So here I have to wait, so to speak, 2 time units. And in the limit, I mean, this sort of drops out completely. And it's clear, since things are independent, that what I get in the limit are just independent Poisson points. And then I get a directed polymer problem, which looks like this. Okay, so here are my Poisson points, I guess, like this here. Okay. I still have to sort of collect maximal energy. So I want to go to a maximal number of points. So I start with my walk down here. I end up with the walk on this side. It's directed, so both coordinates have to increase. So it's upright. So here it just means that both coordinates have to increase. And the energy simply corresponds to the number of Poisson points which I collect, and I want to look at the optimal path. So the optimal path simply means the path which collects the maximum number of Poisson points. It's this combinatorial problem which was originally sort of, I mean, not in this form, but which is completely isomorphic to what Weichdeif-Johann studied in their 1999 paper. Okay? And here there are sort of two optimal paths. I mean, you know, sort of it's a little bit degenerate, so in this limit I might have, there's not a unique maximizer, there might be several maximizers. I mean, so in fact we don't really know how many there are, but okay. So this is a quantity which I want to look at. And now you could ask yourself, you know, since we know that any directed polymer problem must correspond to a Grose process, let me have a look at what is the corresponding Grose process, and that's actually not so hard to discover. So the Grose process is something which is called the PNG droplet, and it's extremely simple. What I do is, let me first explain the model and then tell you what is the connection to the directed polymer. So I have a ground layer which goes from minus T to T, and then I have sort of a random event, which means random nucleation. So, you know, somewhere on the surface, randomly in space-time, I nucleate extra layers, which initially have sort of width zero, but then they meet. I randomly nucleate with width zero, and then the deterministic part of the evolution takes over. The deterministic part simply means that an upstep goes to the left with speed 1, and the downstep goes to the right also with speed 1. And when there is sort of an upstep and downstep which are going to collide, I mean, they simply coalesce. And that's all. Okay? So it's a very simple dynamical rule. And so under this dynamical rule, if I generate an extra level of width 0, then it immediately gains in width because, you know, they're just separating this unit speed. Okay. So here's the connection to the Grose model. Okay. So let's see. How should I? Okay. So maybe I should do this first with the blackboard so I can understand what's going on. So now I'm plotting the PNG model, but in a space-time plot, so I have x which is going this way, and now I'm plotting upwards, I'm plotting t actually. And the fact that I nucleate only above the ground layer means that I can nucleate only in the forward light cone. So this is sort of, okay. Now at some point there will be a nucleation event, let's say over here. And then what I'm plotting in my space-time plot, I'm plotting simply the position of the left mover and of the right mover. So that's something which opens up like this, okay. Now then there will be maybe another nucleation event over here. Then this is the left moving step and the right moving step. And at some point, I mean, these simply meet and then they coalesce and so they completely disappear from the picture. So I have now this piece here. Okay, then there will be another nucleation event over here. Okay, there will be another nucleation event over here. It just goes like this. Maybe another one over here, etc. Right? So this is how it goes. And if I want to know what is the height, I mean, then since I have this ground layer, I have here the height 1, here I have the height 2, here I would have the height 3. If I want to know the height at some given position at time t, then, I have simply to cross-cut, and this gives me then the value of the height function. Okay? So this is this picture, what I've plotted over here. And if I turn this by 45 degrees, then you see that I get just exactly the directed polymer. And so the connection is that the maximal energy sort of tilted by 45 degrees, it's exactly the same as the height. So the maximal energy means that I'm simply maximizing over all paths, and L of omega is sort of the number of Poisson points along the path. Okay. So, you know, it's the same thing, I mean, but it's just sort of done slightly differently. Okay, so now with this input, I can explain to you, so let's go back to this one. I can explain to you where the extra lines come from, okay? So this one looks, of course, very similar to what we had before. You see, if I now plot this thing for a macroscopic time, I mean, now think again in terms of space against height. So I'm plotting here x against the height h. Then you know, nothing can nucleate above the ground layer. So asymptotically, you see something like this. This is a case where the lambda, you know, has the other sign. It's negative, and then there are some fluctuations around it. I mean, this is sort of what you will see after a long time. Okay. So there's still a single line. So this hasn't helped. But now comes this construction, which sort of originally comes from representation theory, and the original paper is sort of, I mean, I don't know, at least for me, sort of certainly much too difficult to digest. But the idea is simple, and you can sort of translate this into our picture, and then it's extremely transparent what is. So this is Robinson, Schenstedt, and Knuth. Knuth is the one from the LaTeX. I mean, that's one of his mathematical works. Okay, this is why he invented LaTeX, in order to type his papers. I mean, so. Anyway, so here comes sort of, and it's an extremely nice and simple idea. So it's more actually sort of the idea which comes. I mean, once you have the idea, then the rest sort of follows. So it's okay. Let me show you what this idea is. Okay. So what I want to, so I imagine that I have my top line, which is H0. So this is just let me do this again here for the. So the top line is this. This P and G line. So here is so this is x. Okay. So here I have now height in this direction, and I nucleate only over the layer from t to minus t. And so let's imagine that up to this time there was no nucleation event. Then what I will see is just sort of a flat surface, and this is sort of H zero, right? Okay. So this is what I'm plotting over here. So I have nothing done than plotted sort of the initial condition for my P and G growth. And now what I want to do is I want to add extra lines, sort of the bookkeeping lines, and they are placed, go all the way to minus infinity, and they are just sort of displaced by one unit. So this is distance one, and that's another distance one, and they just go all the way to minus infinity. Okay? That's easy enough. Okay. So now the question is, so now I have many lines. The question is, how do they evolve? Okay? Now, what I do is, for the top line, I just do exactly my same old rule, because after all, you know, eventually I want to analyze my growth process. So this I don't want to tamper with. So the H0 evolves according to these rules, which I just showed you, okay? Now the question is, what do these other ones do? Well, you know, I just have to add one extra slightly rule, okay? So the top one is the P and G dynamics, okay? And now all the lower ones evolve according to a deterministic rule. So there's no extra noise, and just exactly as the PNG with one extra rule. So let me show you this. So let's imagine that. Let me show you one piece here. Okay, so I have to make this. Okay, imagine that the top line. Okay, so this was from t to minus t, and here is my height. Okay, imagine that there was a nucleation event, and so the top line looks something like this here. Okay. No, sorry, I have to do this in a reverse order. Okay, so. Okay, so let me first I have to explain here first. I cannot start. So let's imagine that somewhere in my big collection of lines, I see two sort of adjacent up and down steps which are going to coalesce. Then what I do is, this is the extra rule which I have to add. What I do is I simply copy this event to the line below. And so at the line below it looks like a nucleation event, but it's perfectly deterministic because it comes from the coalescence event of the line above. So now I can tell you how this goes. I mean, so imagine that at some point I have generated here such a nucleation event over here, and then there's another nucleation event over here. And let's imagine that the top line at this particular time looks like this. Okay, and here I have all the other lines. Okay, then as this continues, I mean, this one is sort of moving like this. This is moving outwards, and at this point they coalesce, and then of course this disappears, and I immediately generate a spike down here, and then I continue, and this is how I simply continue through the whole sort of collection of lines. Okay, so the information which I have up here is sort of tripling down the lines, and this is sort of, I call them bookkeeping, because in this way I don't lose any information. So if at some point I give you the collection of all these lines, I run it backwards, I reconstruct the exact space-time location of the nucleation events. Okay. Yeah, so let me show you sort of a slightly bigger picture. I mean, this is sort of what it looks like. So the top line is our growth process, and these other lines are sort of this extra bookkeeping lines. And of course down here nothing is excited. I mean, they just stay all the way sort of put, because you know there was sort of no time for this kind of coalescence events to triple down and sort of to excite the line. So again, you know, it's very similar to what I told you about the six vertex model. There's a disordered region, which is this one over here. And then down here, sort of, it's completely perfectly ordered in the sense these lines sort of are not excited, and of course here it's just empty. So in that sense, both regions are ordered. So it's again, you have an interface between a disordered region and an ordered region, and the quantity which I'm really interested in is the top line, which is obviously the interface between the ordered and the disordered region by construction. Okay, so now comes here, I showed you another one. This is one, where was the question when I can get another beta? I mean, anyway, so this is an even larger line for some other type model, so you can do many of these things, okay? Okay, now comes the theorem. Maybe that's the only thing which I still tell you. Okay. So the theorem is actually not very difficult. I mean, it's more sort of the conception of the theorem. And this is a theorem sort of before taking any scaling limit. I mean, this is sort of really which sort of does the mapping from the original growth process to something which looks like a multi-matrix model. Okay, and the theorem is the following. So so what I do is I take independent random walks. They are labeled by 0, minus 1, etc., all the way to minus infinity, and time parameter is x, and the x goes between plus t and minus t. Okay, so you should think of these random walks as these objects here, right? I mean, this. So think. I mean, of course, that's not exactly, doesn't have the statistics of the random walk, but I mean, this would be one of these random walks, right? I mean. Okay. Now I want to pin them at both ends, and you know, as you can see from this picture, you know, they are pinned here at this location, they are pinned to the same thing on the other side. So this is what I want to stipulate. So these lines at minus t and plus t must be at level j, and j goes from 0, minus 1, minus 2, etc., all the way to minus infinity. Okay. Now I take all these lines and now I condition them not to cross. So I throw away all the events where they cross, and then I get something which is sort of, okay. It's again sort of a limiting procedure to do this for finitely many and take the limit. Anyway, so you get, this is sort of a well-defined operation. Okay? Now, of course, I get, so I have done this particular construction, okay? And now the assertion of the theorem is that the statistics of these objects are identically to the statistics of these multi-lines in the RSK construction. So the point is that, you know, this is something which is accessible to analysis, and therefore if I do this construction and I look at the top line, I get indirectly, because, you know, the top line is still governed by my Gross process, I will get an information about the statistics of the top line if I work sufficiently hard. Okay, so this is the good news. So this gives us a tool to do some analysis. On the other side, the bad news is that I've thrown away some very important information. Namely, you see, if I look at this Gross process, so here I have again my dynamics, and so let's assume that this is sort of my height, and so this is at some other time t, and this is maybe t over 2. I could ask, what about the correlations between the height at this time and this other time? Or, you know, if I think in terms of my direct, I could ask myself not only about the energy fluctuations, which is what I'm doing over here, but, you know, what about, for instance, if this is the polymer, what about the statistics of these side dot fluctuations, which should go like t to the 2/3? This is completely thrown out by this analysis, because you see, what the theorem tells you is, you know, I run things up to a fixed time t, and then it's telling me what is the statistic of these lines. If I'm asking for information which refers to two different time points, then this construction simply doesn't give me any answer. And that's the reason, you know, why I make always sort of this complicated sort of roundabouts. The point is that it's not true that the KPC equation is mapped to random matrices. I mean, that's simply wrong. There's some partial information which is contained in the KPC equation which happens to be mapped to random matrices. And the information which is lost is that there are no informations about, in this language, sort of about time-like events. You see, if you ask, I mean, the time corresponds to sort of space-like events would be okay. I mean, if there's a point here and a point over here, I mean, then of course I can ask the joint statistics. I mean, this is fine. But if I'm asking about events which are sort of, you know, succeeding each other in time, then I have simply, from this construction, you know, just sort of, it's just blank. It just doesn't tell me anything. Okay, let me show you another construction along the similar line. That's sort of a good point when I can stop, actually. You know, there's another way which I like personally, because it's sort of a nice recursive construction, which sort of, you know, you might have thought about before, but it gives exactly the same kind of thing. So let me explain you the recursive construction. They're all sort of with the aim of constructing sort of a multi-line model, which you can sort of analyze then. Anyway, so here's the recursive construction. So this is how I construct H naught. So this was the picture which I erased already. So these are these Poisson points. I mean, these are these nucleation events, and I'm drawing here the world lines of the upsteps and the downsteps. These green points are the points where two steps annihilate. The height is 1, 2, 3, and at one fixed time, I would have to make this crosscut. Then this gives me exactly the height profile at that particular time, right? So that's the construction which we had. Now we do a I do a recursive construction, and this recursive construction will construct out of H naught, will construct me the next lower sitting lines H minus 1 up to a uniform translation. And what I will do is I simply copy the green points. Now, of course, the red points, they are by definition Poisson, so they are completely uncorrelated. right? Now, the recursive construction means that in the next stage, I simply copy the green points to my next square. Of course, there will be no longer Poisson. I mean, they are now correlated through this sort of, you know, through this nucleation and coalescence events. They have some statistics. Anyway, I copy them over here, and then I simply repeat the construction. So I regard them now as nucleation points, and these blue dots are now the coalescence events. Okay? And the height is, of course, again, 1, 2, 3. If I sort of take a cross cut like this, this gives me the height line with label minus 1 at time t. And then you see that after a while, I mean, if I do this several times, if I fix t, if I do this several times, I mean, then there's simply no point left, right? And then, of course, I just have a perfectly flat line. So that's another way of doing this this recursive construction. The point is, it's not only the construction, but you see, the claim is that I get exactly the right statistics of these lines in this way. All right, so now I guess to be done. I mean, this is actually what I wanted to tell you, but I think time is up, and so that's a very good point to stop. I mean, what do you have to do next? I mean, now you see you have to do edge scaling in the sense that I've told you what is the statistics of all these lines. I mean, so I've told you, you know, how to construct the statistics of these lines, but now I have to analyze what is the statistics of the top line. That's exactly the same thing as the analysis which I have to do, which I didn't tell you how to do it, exact the same kind of analysis which I have to do for this matrix value diffusion processes. You see, it's a well-defined diffusion process, but now I have to take n going to infinity and analyze what is the statistics of the top line in the limit as n goes to infinity. It's a similar kind of thing. I let t go to infinity, but I have to analyze what is the statistics of this top line. And this is sort of how all these determinants and Tracy Widom type distributions, etc., appear. Okay? So to be done means that first of all, I have to do the edge scaling for the line ensemble, and then there's another level which sort of requires some extra attention, which, you know, there are some extra points which I haven't explained yet. For instance, you would like to sort of, in fact, I mean, from this kind of analysis, you can actually obtain the stationary two-point function, and I mean, sort of just for the people who do a little bit sort of turbulence and this kind of thing. But what this actually means is that it's a prediction for what should be the two-point function of the Noisy-Burgers equation. So let me sort of basically come back to the very first equation which I wrote down. I mean, so if you take the KPC equation in one dimension, and then you define u to be the gradient of h, then you substitute this, you will find that it satisfies this Noisy-Burgers equation. And what this method allows you is actually to compute the stationary. So now I want it stationary. So actually, for this case, I sort of know in some sense what the stationary measure is. So I look at the stationary two-point function. And what this method predicts for you is what is the scaling form for the two-point function when I look at large x and large t. Yes? Just exactly the way how I've written it here. You see, the point is... I mean, when I say space-like, is that, you see... Okay, so what I meant is that... Yeah. See, here I'm doing sort of a U of... if I think in terms of the directed polymer, you see, it's the point is that I had... going from this to this, but now of course you see somehow my initial conditions are very special. I multiply here with the U0, and this is sort of somewhat different average. It's not this cone geometry, it's not the droplet geometry. So this is why I'm saying is that you have to do some sort of, you know, I mean, there's some extra arguments which allows you to cover such kind of things. But the point is that it still refers in some sense to two times. You see, it's sort of time zero and time t, if you want. So I think in terms of directed polymer.
Did you show this function?
Yes. You want to know? Okay. I have to find it first. Okay. So what is the scaling function? Let's see. What I want to say is that you know, once you have these tools, I mean, you can do a lot of things. And one of what I personally think is one of the most important results is that you can actually get the scaling function. For this case, and let me show you. It's a very boring function. I mean, there's nothing much I can say about it. this is the scaling function. And I guess you like to see this in Fourier space. No? Well, that's sort of the usual way how you write it, right? I mean, you think of this sort of in Fourier space. This is... What is this function?
What is y?
Well, y, it's a scaling function. So okay, so let me...
So you're scaled?
Okay, so all right, okay. So, now I see. Some part of the audience sort of... okay, so here, let me show you what it is. So what is... The claim is the following. I mean, so I look at this stationary two-point function, right? Okay. Okay, then there are, again, non-universal factors. So these I leave off. And so this should be approximately for t going to infinity and x going to infinity. No. Of course, in the way of how I'm going to write it down just in a moment. So there will be the scaling function, which I called f, I guess. So that's f. Okay. Well, and then it goes like, I mean, this is sort of the Seifert thing. So it goes like t to the minus 2/3 times x. And this is t to the minus 2/3. Okay. That's the scaling form. I mean, up to some prefactors and other non-universal factors, which I did not put. But I mean, the assertion is that you know, when this is of order 1, I mean, then you will see this in your scaling. And what I'm plotting here is the only sort of interesting information which is left, which is this function here.
Is there an analytic expression for you?
Yes, but you know, it's again, I mean, you should sort of think about this analytic expression that it's giving in terms of infinite dimensional determinants. And so actually to do this plot, I mean, you have to sort of work a little bit. But the point is that, I mean, this is the way how it goes. I mean, you do this sort of edge scaling type of analysis, you get an expression which involves sort of determinants. And then you know, then there's sort of a separate issue of how to actually compute the determinants in a sensible way.
It's a Pahlen-Weyl
2, but you see, we are looking now at the stationary case, so it's more than Pahlen-Weyl 2. I mean, you have to, it's more complicated. I mean, but it is related to Pahlen-Weyl 2. Yes, but it's not just like solving a sort of like, you know, solving the ordinary differential equations, a little bit more complicated, but it's okay, you know, it's doable. I mean, you can see this. I mean, here, maybe I just want to show you in Fourier space. I mean, this is.
Why do you show the dashed line?
That's a good question. Actually, I don't really remember why I showed the dashed line. Oh, no. The point is that the dashed line is sort of a fit to this function which we tried at that time, which is the one which is the exponential of y. I think we know that the tails are described by this. You know, I mean, the point is that it's not that explicit, and so I mean, I think, for instance, this 2.5. I mean, that sort of comes out of the theory, and you know, let me show you. Maybe, I don't know. This is something in Fourier space. I mean, so again, looks quite innocent, but I guess the reason why we plotted it is that. You see this dip, which sort of tells you that detailed balance is violated. I mean, you know, if you would have detailed balance, then in Fourier space this function should be positive, but in fact it's not. Here, let me show you sort of more details. I mean, this is sort of for large k. You see these twiggles, which are actually quite in good accordance with mode coupling theory. And here's another plot which I like to show. I mean, you know, these are fairly fine details. They are numerical simulations directly of the noisy Burgers equation, which sort of can reproduce. I mean, that's a paper by Katzhoff and Schwartz, which can actually sort of reproduce. You know, I mean, this is k going up to 6. I mean, which can reproduce. I mean, sort of the first two dips. I mean, then things sort of become numerically sort of hard. Actually, okay. So it has some structure, but not. You see, the theoretical question is really what exactly, in terms of noisy Burgers equation, what exactly you have to do. I mean, you know, you know, how do you actually discretize the equation in order to get these things? And so, okay, there. Anyway, so I should stop here. Thank you.
when you said that random matrices don't have cheetah intercepts, extra intercepts, don't have scaling, they have only one cell but not two cells.
The random matrices.
You said that there is no direct connection between Bruggers and random matrices, and you can recover scaling cheetah in one cell, but you cannot recover cross transversal.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah.
I think you can. You have to look not at the eigenvalue, but at the eigenfunction. So if you take eigenfunction for this random matrix, and you analyze distortion of this eigenfunction from, say, kind of uniform or something, then you would recover the other, this transversal equation.
You explained to me how to do that. Yeah, no, it's a good point. I mean, yeah, I just don't, yeah. Okay, very good. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's something which can be done, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes?
You showed the relation some time earlier ago where you condition on these curves not to intersect, and that corresponds to beta equals
2.
And you said that if beta is not equal to 2, that is the random matrix is not just preferring on the Clojure, it's not preferring on, then something has to be modified. What is it that has to be modified?
Let's see, I guess, okay, so I'm not completely sure. Okay, so what are you, well, let's see, what has to be modified? Okay, so I guess what I'm referring to is that if you take for instance the flat initial conditions. I mean, this corresponds to beta equal to 1. Okay. Now, what has to be modified is that if you just follow this construction, you will get a line ensemble, which is interacting and which cannot be. I mean, all these kind of things are eventually sort of based on using free fermion methods.
Yeah.
Right. And so then for instance, if you start with the flat initial condition, which you prove then to be actually beta equal to 1, it's not no longer based on sort of direct free fermion methods. I mean, there are some other tricks which are not so easily described and which are not. I mean, there's another. I guess what I want to say is that as soon as you go away from beta equal to 2, then you can no longer use really free fermion methods.
In other words, if beta equal 1, free fermions, all these probabilities are Fredholm determinants. And if it's not
determinants,
Fredholm very hard.
Well, they're already, yeah, that's right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, but if you look at the analysis of the flat case, I mean, you see that the free fermion method is sort of replaced by something else. I mean, it's sort of no longer direct free fermion, I mean.
Mm-hmm.